You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 42, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to the show. Now, digging right in, we're going to continue where we left off last issue. We're going to cover both Thor number 354 and also Thor Vikings number 2. But before we do that, we have an edition of Just for Valhallavit. For those of you who don't know the feature, which is to say those of you who have come on board thanks to the Comics Podcast Network, this is a feature where we explore the inclusion of mythology, in particular Norse mythology, in other entertainment venues outside of comics. And this time around, I've decided that it would be only appropriate for us to cover the appearance of various Norse gods in the work of Douglas Adams. For any of you who have been living under a rock for the last 30 years, Douglas Adams, of course, the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Dirk Gently novels, among many other things, including a stint as story director and script editor for the TV series Doctor Who. Despite Adams' self-identification as a radical atheist, he often considered mythological and religious themes in his work, including a number of appearances by the god Thor. The first of which was only a brief cameo, was in the second Hitchhiker's book, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. While this first appearance barely even qualifies as a cameo, Thor does make a later appearance in the Hitchhiker series in the book, Life, the Universe, and Everything, where he is attending a party along with the main characters. In that appearance, Thor is portrayed as very hot-headed and not very smart, which actually would be fairly consistent with Norse mythology. Thor makes one final appearance in the Hitchhiker's universe, though not penned by Douglas Adams himself, in the novel And Another Thing by Owen Colfer. Thor is actually a major character in that book, having established that he is an acquaintance of Zaphod Beeblebrox. He eventually becomes the god of the planet Nano, and thereby is restored to his godly heritage, I suppose you could say. Outside of the Hitchhiker's universe, Douglas Adams used Thor in his second Dirk Gently novel, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul. In my opinion, this is by far more interesting than anything we saw in the Hitchhiker series. For one thing, I'm a big fan of the Dirk Gently novels, and it's a huge shame that there really weren't more of them. In this book, Adams is playing with quasi-religious and mythological themes. Foremost of those ideas is the concept that humans create gods in their own image, and they become real in the physical world. And of course, as the Norse gods lost their worshippers, they became more and more destitute and lost their memories along with most of their abilities as time went on. Adams portrays the Norse gods in the story as kind of bums and bag ladies and that sort of thing, just kind of wandering aimlessly around the streets. However, once an immortal being is created, the immortal being remains immortal. In this book, we do see the gods being able to re-enter Valhalla ultimately, which shares the same space-time in approximate dimension as St. Pancras train station in London. In the story, we actually do have a fair amount of interaction between Dirk Gently and Thor, as Thor is trying to get back to Norway to ascend back into Valhalla. We also get to see Odin doing an advertisement on television for soft drinks. So really, really funny stuff there. I would love to see what else Adams could come up with as far as the Norse gods as characters. However, with Adams' death in 2001, that makes that highly unlikely now. Now, despite the fact that Adams really didn't have the opportunity, unfortunately, with his untimely death, to write a lot more stuff involving Norse mythology or mythological gods in general, what he did write has had a profound influence on other writers. And I think that one of the most obvious writers that has been highly influenced by Adams' work in this regard has been, of course, the novelist and graphic novelist Neil Gaiman. You can see a lot of commonality in the sort of story structure and the sense of humor and other aspects of the writing as well between Adams and Gaiman. It's clear that Adams was a very strong influence on Neil Gaiman, and his writing is so much the better for it as far as I'm concerned. Needless to say, Neil Gaiman adopting a lot of the same kinds of themes as Douglas Adams does, we will eventually be having a Just for the Hell of It devoted to the work of Neil Gaiman, maybe even more than one, because he, after all, is still producing lots and lots of work. In a very real sense, though, I think that Adams' work in The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul is directly reflected in Gaiman's novel American Gods. The two works are very different in style and tone, but thematically there are a lot of common elements. All right, so that's it for this edition of Just for Valhalla of It. And as always, if you know of any other appearances by the Norse gods in popular media outside of comics, please let me know. And you can do that by emailing the show. Our email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. All right, so without further ado, let's move on to our reviews.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar.
You like movies about gladiators?
Indeed. So, as we continue on, we're going to start out this time with Thor Vikings number 2. The cover date is October of 2003, retailed for $3.50, and the credits are Garth Ennis, writer, Glenn Fabry, artist, Paul Mounts was the colorist. Beautiful color, by the way. I love Paul Mounts' coloring. Dave Sharp on letters, and Joe Quesada was the editor and the editor-in-chief. We have a beautiful painted cover by Glenn Fabry with Thor and Harold Jackelson just sort of face-to-face going rawr at each other. Just really awesome and yeah, bloody and bumpy and yeah, just generally very detailed and very Glenn Fabry-y. We open up to the splash page where we have the title of the story, Kingdom of Iron, and Thor and Hackleson are facing off. And Hackleson says, "No inkling is it who you face? No idea at all? Hazard a guess, Thunder God. Some crawling thing of night and cemetery born? A maggot fresh escaped from hell. It was no underworld that spat me out. Never have I felt the cold embrace of soil. You think me a maggot? Strike and see." And Thor leaps up with his hammer and is going to give Jackelson just this enormous pop with his hammer. We see a giant crack and a huge like plume of lightning coming out. And Jackelson is completely unmoved by this. And we see that Thor has severely damaged both of his hands. You say, Glenn Fabry and his sort of love for the grotesque has had like Thor's hands like twist around and you can see the bones sticking through. And Thor doesn't look like he's real happy about that. And Jackelson says, "That was not my skull breaking. Well, the city will not raid itself. Do not stand and gawk like halfwits. Go set about our business here. Be Vikings!" And the zombies just sort of shamble off to kind of rape and pillage as they will. And Jackelson backhands Thor, whose hands are kind of flopping around loosely. Does, "I need no help with this one." And we see a number of pages of Jackelson soldiers kind of raping and pillaging in New York City. Like I was saying in my review last issue, absolutely gorgeously drawn, but really over the top violence for no apparent real reason. Other, of course, than the fact that this is a quote-unquote adult comic. Lots of people being beheaded, lots of cars and buildings burning, lots of smoke rising up. And basically we have various scenes of what the Vikings are up to. We see some of them are bursting into a step aerobics class and Lord knows what happens there. They don't show it. We then have a horde of these Vikings attacking a school bus and you see like blood coating the inside of the school bus. We then cut back to Thor, who's kind of laying around on the ground with his hands kind of bent at weird angles. And Jackelson is taunting him, "No hands to hold your hammer? Ill tidings for the mighty Thor. No means of striking at your foe. No calling down the lightning. No flight. you'll have to run away instead. And Thor just is enraged by this. Says, I say thee nay, and he kicks Jack Olsen and kind of knocks him aside and says, nay, thrice nay, and headbutts Jack Olsen. And Jack Olsen just sort of stands there and takes it and says, I say yes. Think quickly, Thunder God, so long as you have a head to think with. And he's swiping at him with his sword. We then cut to a New York City bar where the patrons are watching a television, and we have an anchorman coming on. He's doing a news story about the invading Viking zombies.
Just reaching us now, some sort of invasion of Lower Manhattan, with one eyewitness describing the attackers as ancient warriors armed with swords. Casualties are apparently high, including numerous fatalities. The invaders reportedly slaughtering everything in their path. A spokesman for the mayor's office advised people not to panic. We've been assured that the mayor himself is currently out of town, but is being kept fully informed of the situation. Meanwhile, police emergency units are on their way to the scene. Exactly who the invaders are and what their intentions might be remains open to question, with attacks reported as far as Wall Street and Columbus Circle. Our own Max Mills is outside our Midtown studio now. Max, what can you tell us about the situation? Hello? Max? Max, are you there? Well, we seem to have lost Max for the...
And he's sitting there, and we see the Viking zombies break in the studio behind him and decapitate him on camera. Of course, yeah, because, you know, that's what we do in this book. And we see these three guys who are sitting at the bar, and they say, oh, man, poor bastard. Hasn't this city suffered enough?
Somebody's going to get sued over this. I'll tell you that for nothing.
I'm going to go home and get my camcorder.
And there's a zombie Viking kind of looming up behind them, and this is a big giant swipe of his sword decapitates all three of them. And then we see a couple of these Vikings trashing the bar. And we then cut to, yeah, we see like they're trashing a store. And then we see one of the Vikings in front of the TV camera making a throat-cutting motion in front of the camera. And lots of gore kind of spurting up. Yeah, a lot of gore. And I think, for my taste, a bit much gore, actually. We then cut back to Thor and Jack Olsen, and Jackalson's still taunting Thor.
You're worth no iron of mine, pretender. Some god you are. Small wonder you hide out in the mortal world. I doubt they'd let the likes of you in Asgard, you pathetic fleck of spit.
And he picks up Thor by his hair, and it's kind of, and Thor's face is all beat up. It looks like his nose is smashed, and the Jackalson's just kind of grinning, and he's got this big hole where his eye was bit. And I wonder if he's deliberately evoking Odin there. I think he probably is, but yeah, anyway. So he's kind of dragging Thor around by his hair, and he smashes him headfirst into one of these marble pillars at this building where they are. He says,
well, all strength deserted you? No words to fight with, even. Shall I be left to stand all day and slap you as I would a wench?
And Thor tries to speak and says, rot.
Thor's wit, the stuff of legends.
We then cut back to these police helicopters flying over the city, and they kind of land and see the kind of barrier in the road. And as they get close to the barrier, they see that this barrier is made entirely of severed human heads. And there's kind of oozing blood out from underneath this huge wall of heads that's blocking the road. We then cut back to Jack Olsen and Thor, and they're still on the docks. And Jack Olsen is still taunting Thor.
So none but you can lift the hammer? Is that how it works? Well, there's a way around every problem.
And he's taken Thor's hammer and tied it with a chain around Thor's neck, like kind of a noose thing. And he drags Thor to the edge of the dock by his foot. He
says, this will not kill you. No god worth speaking of can drown. But you can crawl away and lick your wounds and heal, and ever remember the lesson taught to you this day. So go, return to Asgard. Cower there with the other so-called gods. Lick up the scraps the true heroes throw you from their tables in Valhalla.
And he kicks Thor into the river. We see that Thor's face is all ripped up. He's like, go die the straw death. What he means by that is, you know, die in your bed and not in battle. That's sort of the coward's death in Norse mythology. And he says, as Thor is sinking to the bottom of the river,
I'll build my kingdom here.
And Thor's kind of goes to the bottom, and you see all this garbage and stuff sitting at the bottom of the river. And then Jack Olsen gathers his troops together, says, they come, do they? Good. Get to your places. Raise the sail. It's time this was decided.
And the caption says, some say the Norsemen had a sorcerer among their number. Others that they'd sailed their long ship to the underworld and bargained with the kings of darkness. They all kind of board their ship, and the ship takes off into the air and starts flying through New York City. I love the figurehead on the ship. It's got this this really weird expression on its face, like, nah. It's a really very bizarre sort of dragon-headed thing. And the caption goes on to say, whichever it was, what happened next will be recalled until the day of Ragnarok. The ship is kind of sailing through the sky down one of these long, wide boulevards in New York City, and there's like soldiers and police there with all kinds of guns and stuff, and the ship gets closer and closer, and they finally, the commander, whoever this is, shouts, fire! And they shoot all their guns, and that Jackalson says, aye. And then fire comes out of the figurehead, this dragon head, and this huge blast of fire comes down, and you see it incinerating the police and soldiers as it touches them, and just kind of burns them all to a crisp. And the Vikings jump down, and the captions are saying that the battle only lasts minutes, and the soldiers are firing down from helicopters, but you know, the Vikings are throwing swords and spears into the helicopters, and the helicopters are crashing and burning, and everyone's dying, and lots of graphically, beautifully rendered gore like last issue. And the caption says, to those who lived to speak of it, the minutes seemed an age. And we see kind of the aftermath of the battle, and the policemen and the soldiers are running away, lots of dead bodies around. The caption's gone, their champion lay fallen. The protectors staggered from the field, those few that would not feed the ravens and the wolves. Like, there's like a lot of ravens and wolves in New York City to feed. The people of the city cowered in their homes, quaking as they gazed on sights not seen for near 1,000 years. So began the reign of Harold Jackalson over the New World. We then cut to the pier along the river here, the Hudson River, and Thor kind of dragging himself up one of these metal stair things up the side of a pier at this chain wrapped around his neck. And he's going, and he's kind of this beat up wreck. And he's one of the wings on his helmet has been broken off. And he's leaning back all bloody against a wall. And he looks up and he says, strange. And on the last page of the story, we see what he's talking about. Indeed, it is strange. Doctor Strange, that is. The Sorcerer Supreme, and he's kind of looking down at Thor disdainfully, thinking, downright bizarre, I'd say. I think we need to talk. To be continued. And that is Thor Vikings number 2. Now, you'll notice that it only took about 10 minutes for me to summarize that entire issue. Quite ironically, I actually kind of read every piece of dialogue, every little caption. There's really nothing of this issue that I left out. And this is sort of that phenomenon that we had talked about in prior episodes, where they really just kind of don't pace these stories properly. They're paced to fit in a 6-issue trade paperback. So there are parts of the story which are just kind of all action, not a lot of dialogue needed. In this case, lots of decapitation and brains spraying out and blood oozing and just sort of this grotesque stuff that Glenn Fabry loves to draw. Now, having read this series in the past, I know that it does get more story involved as we go forward. There are more characters, there's more going on, it's going to become more complex. We're not going to be able to sum up every issue in 10 minutes, but it certainly isn't like it was back in the day, or even where we are with Walt Simonson back in 1985, where the story is more complex. There's just more story per issue, and you got the same page count here. You got 23, 24 pages of story, which is exactly what we had back in the 60s and all the way up into the Simonson era. So it is just one of those things, I guess. Anyway, speaking of the Simonson era, we're going to move along then to the other issue that we're reviewing this time. This is Thor number 354. Came out in April of 1985, retailed for 65 cents. Oops, the price went up. I can only dream of comics being 65 cents again. But alas, that will never happen. So on the splash page, we pick up right where we left off last issue. Odin has fallen with Surtur down into a giant chasm back to Muspelheim, and Thor and Loki left behind, screaming together, Father! They're standing among the smoking ruins here in Asgard. And Thor's very displeased, is like, he's gone! Lord Odin is gone! And Loki's thinking to himself, unbelievable, but Thor is right. Even my magic can sense no trace of them. Odin and Surtur no longer exist anywhere in the Nine Worlds. Now at last, my time has come to... What? No! And Thor is actually hammering on the ground, trying to open up this gateway into Muspelheim to get Odin back. And he's like, fear not, father, though I may split Asgard asunder. By the power of my enchanted hammer, I shall reopen the fiery path to Muspelheim and find thee. And Loki tries to stop him. Thor, Thor, cease this fruitless effort ere 'tis too late. You cannot help our father now.
Unhand me, traitor. Odin lies somewhere with his foe in the depths of Muspelheim, and nothing shall prevent me from seeking him out.
And he bats Loki aside like nothing, and Loki's kind of laying there in the rubble, making fun of Thor, actually, in a way.
Sometimes, Thor, I despair of you. Is this how you repay your debts of gratitude? Without my help, neither you nor Odin could have prevented Surtur from destroying everything. As for our father, I think he is not dead, for his power would have passed to us as his brothers passed to him.
We saw that back in Thor 349.
If indeed Odin and Surtur return to Muspelheim, then only Odin's power prevents Surtur from breaking into the Nine Worlds again. Should you reopen the gateway into that deadly realm, you may even release the demon and thereby undo all that we have accomplished. So think carefully before you recklessly blast your way into Muspelheim. Use what little brains you have, brother.
It takes no brains, Loki, to see where your thoughts are already turning. Even you must have realized that Surtur meant the destruction for us all, and who would rule a smoking ruin. Yet there is truth in what you say, for once. I do owe you a debt of gratitude, and the Odin power has not returned to Asgard. But know this, brother, as you plot behind your eyes, I shall be watching you.
Then I hope to make interesting viewing.
Of that, brother, I have no doubt.
We then cut back to Earth as the forces of Carnilla the Norn Queen are converging on the site of the multidimensional gate that they destroyed last issue, the one that led from Muspelheim into the Sahara Desert. And we have Carnilla and the Warriors Three and Beta Ray Bill, and they're all just standing there. And this huge throng of Surtur's armies are kind of approaching them, ready to attack. And Beta Ray Bill thinks that they're attacking even more fiercely than ever before. But as they watch, all of these demons begin to smoke, and they burst into flames, and their bodies are devouring themselves with a giant roar. And they all kind of burst into this giant conflagration and are gone. And the Asgardian armies are like, we've won, hooray! And Beta Ray Bill is,
heroes of Asgard, allies of the Nornland, the victory is ours. The desert is clean once more.
And everybody's cheering and celebrating. And Baldur is there with Carnilla, and Fandral greets him.
Baldur, my friend, you and the Norn Queen arrived at a most propitious moment. Glad we were to see you and the Horse of Nornland come to our aid in the 11th hour.
But Carnilla doesn't want to stick around and celebrate.
Says, and that, Fandral, is all you shall see of him.
Little desire have I to remain on Midgard now that the battle is won. Through my eldritch sorceries we shall return from whence we came, and brave Baldur shall go with me. For he said that he would know me better, and I shall hold him to his word. And with a giant fwithap,
there's a giant yellow like bolt of lightning comes down, and the Norn Queen and Baldur and all of her army are gone. And Fandral's kind of disturbed by the fact that Baldur's gone off with the Norn Queen, and this,
Volstagg, do you see? Unbelievable that Baldur should permit himself to be carried off by that creature. I don't know, Fandral. You should be so lucky to have such a nice, warm place to go home to.
And Beta Ray Bill then approaches the Warriors Three and basically says now that the battle's over that he must return with all due haste to New York to learn if the Lady Sif is still alive. And the Warriors Three, well, then you better take us with you. And Fandral says that if she's still alive, then Hogun may be needed. The silent warrior, so deadly in combat, doth carry the elixir of recovery. We then shift scenes to New York, and there are these army medics who are treating the wounded, and the demons suddenly vanished from New York City, you know, all the live ones and the dead ones alike. which the medics think that making the wounded humans and Asgardians much easier. And we see the Sif is gravely wounded, and they're afraid that they might lose her. The Beta Ray Bill and the Warriors 3 arrive, but they've arrived in time, and Hogan administers to her the Elixir of Recovery, and it seems like everything is going to be fine with Sif. We then shift scenes to Asgard, where the Rainbow Bridge has been shattered, and Thor is kind of pondering this, and he's looking around the ruins right by the Rainbow Bridge for the Rainbow Bridge's guardian, Heimdall, and he does find him. He's hurt, but he's okay, and Heimdall's like, "Thor, what has happened? Where is..."
"Odin is gone, Watcher of the Worlds, and he has left us behind to mourn for him."
"Odin gone? And we are still alive? Oh, my liege, would that I have died for thee."
It's a passing giants who have some ill intent are creeping by.
"Did you hear that? Odin's gone."
And they are listening to the conversation between Thor and Heimdall. And Thor is explaining to Heimdall how Odin sacrificed himself that the nine worlds might live. And these giants are kind of lurking behind the wreckage listening.
"Time for the frost giants to gather and attack Asgard together."
"Shh, you want he should hear us?"
And as they're eavesdropping on Thor and Heimdall, a great light appears with a giant sisk. And we see Hela, the goddess of death, has come to Asgard. Now, for those of you who've been listening to the show for a while, you remember that we did kind of a little feature on Hela back in episode number 13. If you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. You can download, of course, all of the old shows at radiofreeasgard.com. And Thor is alarmed by this. "Hela, the goddess of death, has come to Asgard." And Heimdall thinks that Hela has come for him because he shall not be long separated from his liege. This seems uncommonly devoted to Odin, doesn't he? It's like a man crush or something. And Hela reassures Heimdall.
"Save thy strength, Heimdall. I do not seek thy paltry life. I have felt a disturbance in the worlds like no other. Surely only Odin's death could have caused it. And yet I do not see his body before me. I do not feel his spirit, and I want it."
"Mayhap, Hela, 'tis because he still lives somewhere beyond your touch."
"Then mayhap, Thor, I should touch you instead and carry you down to hell at last."
"Never, Queen of the Dead."
And he takes his hammer and smashes her with a giant ram, and she goes falling down into the wreckage.
"Thor, you dare!"
"Speak not to me of daring, thou greedy glut. You who have stolen mortal souls for your kingdom, who have taken innocence that deserved better at the hands of death than to be hidden in the dank and clammy halls of hell. You who have now come claiming my father's spirit as though the soul of Odin were some bauble that you had won." And he smashes her again with the hammer with a badoom and sends her flying. "My father may live or he may not, but his soul shall never be thine." Hela's kind of reaching out to Thor, trying to touch him, because, of course, you know, if she touches Thor, he's going to die, because that's her power. And she's thinking,
"Perhaps not Thor, but yours shall be with just a touch."
And Thor dodges that. "Too slow, Death Goddess, for mine is the swiftness of the very lightning itself, and the fury of the elements is as nothing to the fury of Thor this day."
And Hela's starting to get a little worried here. She thinks that she's never seen Thor so angry before. She thinks he's like a raging juggernaut, and that his speed and his anger are beyond comprehension. And she realizes at this point she is not going to beat him. So she kind of turns tail and runs away. And Thor shouts after her, "Flee, Death! Flee and lick thy wounds, you who are not fit to utter my father's name. And know that Thor shall not be far behind. For I have sworn a solemn oath to aid those poor souls who have been enticed into death's unrelenting grasp. Look to thy defenses, the thunder god shall breach them all, and Hela yield up her undead."
And these two giants who were kind of plotting earlier to team up and attack Asgard are thinking,
"Jeez, you thinking what I'm thinking?
I'm thinking a long trip to the mountains would be a good idea about now,"
and they could go running away. And Thor is left standing alone on the Rainbow Bridge, kind of pondering all of the momentous events of the last couple of issues, and thinking that Heimdall wished to be alone in his grief, and I too can scarcely bear another's company. "Oh, my father, what shall we do without you? Wherever I turn, I am reminded of this loss. Already the cosmic storms begin to nibble at the edges of Asgard. Without the bridge, Asgard's connection to Midgard will grow more tenuous with every passing day, until eventually passage to the realm of mortals may become impossible." And he sees this light kind of emerging on the Rainbow Bridge, or what's left of it,
and he thinks that Hela is attacking again, but a form takes place. It's not Hela, but is in fact the goddess Sif, and she's like, Thor!
Sif! Oh, Thor, I was so worried. I thought the bridge was gone. Despite my powers to bypass time and space, I barely reached Asgard. What has happened in the Golden Realm? Thor, where is thy father?
And Thor has to tell her that he is gone.
Unsurprisingly, Sif is pretty shocked by the news, but she seems rather less upset about it than Thor, who then kind of falls to his knees and starts getting all drama queeny and melodramatic, because we all know that Thor is the biggest fucking drama queen in Asgard. Sif tries to comfort him, says,
Thor, my heart, wherever he is, your father knows his son fought unafraid with the courage and gallantry as befits the god of thunder, as he would have wished you to.
Well, no duh, because he was there.
And the continued existence of the nine worlds is the true measure of that endeavor. No matter what the cost, Surtur has failed. Do not punish thyself for deeds no man or god could do.
In this, Sif, my head is not the master of my heart. I would leave Asgard for a time. I must needs weep, and here my tears remain unshed. Think you that Bill would remain on Earth a while and guard the mortals as I have done?
Bill would stay, if I wished it.
As I thought, he loves you as who could not. I would bid you too remain on Earth to guide our people. Without the Rainbow Bridge, returning our warriors home will be no easy task. They must remain on Earth a little while, without the knowledge of Odin's passing.
What a dick! I have to say, Thor is being a real cock here, because he's not going to even tell them that Odin has fallen to save everybody. They're just going to wonder what happened in suspense for the whole time on Earth. That's a really dick move, Thor. But Thor reasons that in their awesome grief that they may do more damage to Earth than Surtur's legions. Come on. Yeah, once again, Thor showing his drama queen tendencies here.
Yet this victory today has taught me something of the sorrows of mortals, who must endure such losses throughout their lives. Therefore, there is a favor I would have you ask of Fandral for me upon your return.
I wonder what that is. I guess we'll find out in a few pages, because we then cut to this stunning, looks like a ski lodge here, and it's on like this snow-covered mountain and beautiful pine trees and really kind of cool, though very simple Viking-looking design of this. It looks like a ski lodge. It really does. And this is where the goddess Frigga and the children have arrived. This is their destination where they went to be safe from Surtur's attack. And Frigga is, you know, telling the children they need to go to bed after, you know, everyone has kind of unpacked and found a place to lay down. And some of the children are whining that Frigga tell them a story, because Volstagg always tells them stories. And Frigga isn't having a lot of patience with this. He says,
when he comes for a visit, he can tell you a story. But I am much too tired to indulge any of you tonight. We'll have a story in the morning. Now close your eyes and go to sleep. I'll come to bed shortly.
And she goes out on this big, like, it's really kind of a patio, sort of like a deck around the ski lodge thing, and she's standing out there, and she's out there, and the children perceive that she's actually crying, and
you were right, Gunnhild, she's crying,
and they kind of go and surround her, this group of children.
Don't cry, Frigga. Father Odin's gone, isn't he? We knew it was going to happen. That's why he sent us away, so we could watch over you. But he'll come back. He wouldn't go off and leave you alone. We're sure Father Odin will come back, won't he?
We then shift scenes back to New York City, where the Warriors of Asgard are bivouacked in Central Park, and Sif pops back in here, and everyone's kind of laying around and recovering from the battle and telling their stories about the battle and all that. And Sif approaches Beta Ray Bill, who asks how things are going in Asgard, and she says,
the Realm Eternal still stands, Bill. Surtur has indeed been defeated. And you? Though I have been gone but a few hours, you look strangely tired.
And he mentions that he's gone off on another adventure with the Avengers and has fought against some dire wraiths in ROM number 65, which I hope to be covering next episode. Sif then hops up on this big rock to address the crowd and says,
heroes of Asgard, I bring a message from Thor, your commander. Though we have won the battle, it has not been without cost. The Rainbow Bridge has been destroyed, and we have been bidden to remain on Midgard for the nonce. When suitable transportation home has been arranged, we shall depart. In the meantime, let us relax amongst the mortals, and behave as good guests among their hosts.
And they're kind of rumbling coming from Volstagg.
Curious that Odin himself came not to greet such valorous heroes.
"Nonsense, Volstagg," says Fandral. "It's time to party."
"Party, Fandral," says Hogan.
"An interesting custom, Hogan. You must let Volstagg and me teach it to you sometime." And Bill and Sif are consulting with the head of the soldiers here, and he's telling them not to really worry about sitting here in Central Park, that he suspects that the mayor can be persuaded to let the Asgardians camp there until such time as they can take them home. Vatory Bill then decides he's going to change into a form that's less conspicuous, and he bangs Stormbreaker, his hammer, on the ground with a giant foof, changes back into his non-Thor clothing, which is not really all that much less conspicuous, but at least it's not as conspicuous as his Beta Ray Thor form. And one of the soldiers suggests that he may be even less conspicuous if he finds some normal clothes to wear, because he is, even though he's not like this horse face alien in that form, he's still like this big orange guy with no ears and no nose and, you know, kind of unusual looking. And so Beta Ray Bill enlists Sif to go help him find some clothing, and she mentions that she needs to give Fandral his message from Thor, and then they shall be on their way. Meantime, in another location in New York, there are a bunch of men gathered before a closed-circuit monitor, and they listen as a harsh voice issuing from the speakers tells them what to do.
"The opportunity is perfect. The city is still recovering from the shocks of the past few days. Now is the time to strike."
Dun, dun, dun. We then shift to a penthouse overlooking Central Park, and we find the beautiful Lorelei, who's kind of being a bit testy and bitchy because the woods are crawling with Asgardians, but Thor hasn't returned to her. I wonder why. And she's wondering why, too, because the golden mead should have him burning with desire for her. And a light kind of illuminates her apartment, and she thinks that it's her sister, the Enchantress, coming back. And she picks up a vase to bop the Enchantress on the head with. But it turns out not to be the Enchantress. It turns out to be none other than Loki. And Lorelei is kind of bitching about her situation and says how she had that visit from the Enchantress, who's threatening to put an end to her little scheme. "She knows about Thor and me. Says she's going to put a stop to it." And Loki says,
"Does she now? Well, you just leave her to me. The stakes are far too high to allow the Enchantress to interfere now."
"Loki, I want to go home. It's dull here. Somehow my hold on Thor seems to have weakened. He hasn't come back to me."
"My dear, if this adulterated mead kept him with you in the first place, my stepbrother's will is far less than I suspected."
Yeah, remember that Roger actually diluted the mead, knowing that this was probably what was causing Thor to act so weird. And Loki says,
"Excellent. Why, with my help, you should be able to convince him of just about anything."
"What did you have in mind?"
"I think the two of you should begin discussing the next ruler of Asgard, which incidentally is why I've come. Thor is even now in the Golden Realm, wounded and heartsick. Poor boy, he needs tending, and you would make a charming nurse. I'm certain you have a most irresistible bedside manner."
And the two of them vanish in a burst of light and vanish silently away, says the caption. We then find Thor leaving Asgard on horseback, and this one doesn't look like Comet the Super Horse because it's brown and has a mohawk, the Asgardian horse version of Mr. T, I guess. And he's bidding farewell to Heimdall here. "Fare thee well, Heimdall. I see my father's ghost wherever I turn, and I am not at peace with it. Guard well this ancient realm. Should you need me, blow upon the mighty Gjallar horn, and I shall be with thee in a trice.
Fare you well, mighty Thor. I shall pray for your swift return."
And he's thinking, "May you find the peace you seek." And we have some time passing here, a number of days at least, as Thor wanders deeper and deeper into the wilderness surrounding Asgard. And at one point he decides he's going to stop, and he camped for the night, sometime around dusk. But he sees a trail of footprints in this region, which is pretty much empty of all life. And he says he could have sworn that the snow was virgin only a moment ago.
"Oh, my.
Come, my friend, let us follow on a little while. We can see if we can discover what other traveler ventures so far from home."
Unbeknownst to Thor, he is being spied upon, not by Odin this time, but a pair of malevolent eyes. Yes, he is being watched by the death goddess Hela, and she's using her own version of the cosmic voyeuroscope to spy on Thor and his mohawked horse. And she's thinking,
the rage of Thor is not to be taken lightly. Should he in truth invade my kingdom, the outcome would be by no means certain, and death should always be certain.
And Hela is actually, you know, she's not able to affect Thor directly from the distance she is, but she decides to start an avalanche. And Thor notices the avalanche is kind of coming down, going kick, kick, kick. And he spurs his horse on to gallop as quickly as the wind and whirls his hammer around trying to bat away the rocks and ice until they've managed to outrace the avalanche. And even though Hela is not able to affect Thor directly from that distance, she decides that she's going to use her power to kill Thor's horse. And she kind of focuses a magical blast through the cosmic voyeuroscope, and it hits Thor's horse kind of on the neck. And Thor's horse begins to fall apart and kind of dissolve into a skeleton and kind of into dust from that. And at just at that point, the avalanche is upon Thor and buries him with a giant baroom. And when all has settled, we don't see any sign of Thor, but we see Mjolnir kind of sitting on top of the snow. And the caption says, and once again, all is silent in the mountains of Asgard. As silent as the grave. And that is the main story of Thor 354. But we actually have a backup feature. Yeah, it's been a real long time since we've had anything like that. But before we get into this backup feature, let's talk about the main story a little bit first. All right, so fair enough. This is a transition issue. This is really the end of a major storyline, and then we really haven't started getting into the major plot threads of the upcoming story yet. So this is one of these weird transitions. As the result of that, it's a kind of an awkward story, storytelling-wise. There really is not a lot of quote-unquote plot there. Not a lot, quote-unquote, really happens there. A lot of it is just sort of catching up with the various characters, seeing what they're up to now that Surtur has been defeated. Really, there's a sense of foreboding, a lot of, you know, people being very uncertain about what's going to be going on, and that comes through pretty well in the story. Now, art-wise, I have to say, this issue was below par for Simonson. Now, granted, below par for Simonson is still a lot better than some artists at their best, but I do have to say that from my perspective, the artwork looks as though it was probably rushed. Also, the scene with the two giants who are plotting to attack Asgard until they witness this knockdown dragout between Thor and Hela, I really do enjoy that part of the story. They could have made the stakes a little bit higher. They kind of played it for humor, but it would have been great if these guys had actually been really menacing and really taken seriously as a threat. They're kind of, you know, kind of nod and a wink here that these guys are kind of goofy, but I get what Simonson was going for, but if you have these two characters that are really sinister and really serious, and they're doing the same thing, and they have the same reaction, the scene would be all the more funny. At least that's my opinion. Anyway, so let's move on. I don't mean to be like really critical of Walt Simonson, because everyone knows I love his stuff. But anyway, let's move on to the backup feature. And remember how we used to have Tales of Asgard back in the old Journey into Mystery stories? In this issue, we have Tales of Midgard, home of the amazing human race. And, of course, this is the same art team and all that stuff. And the story picks up in Chicago. Now, this is really wrapping up some loose plot lines. Because before Simonson took over the book, there had been an editorial change on the book, a writer change on the book. They decided to change the direction of the Thor comic. And they had Dr. Don Blake move to Chicago, open up an office on the Magnificent Mile, and he hired these three women to work for him. And they were not around. I don't remember them being around for that long. I mean, I was certainly reading the book at that point, but I really don't remember that era as lasting particularly long. Seems to me, back in the recesses of my memory, which is, you know, increasingly failing, that at that point the book was floundering pretty badly. Most of the stories were not that great. And this is sort of the business that Thor had Sif take a message to Fandral to resolve. So let's just go ahead and follow. Chicago, Sandberg's City of the Big Shoulders. Talk about Carl Sandburg, the poet there. These first few panels, you have some nice photo reference of the Magnificent Mile area of Chicago. Looks really great. I kind of remember in Thor 337, he had Nick Fury, and they kind of fly past a building that was supposed to be the water tower, and it really didn't look anything like it. And this is a big change from that, because they have a great version in here of the Tribune Tower. Chicago, where hundreds of professional offices are strung along Michigan Avenue's Magnificent Mile. Offices belonging to men of high standings and higher incomes. Though in particular one office, the income is all but gone, and standing is certainly in doubt. We see a door with a sign, Dr. Donald Blake, M.D., and three women inside are talking. And one of them is obviously like his administrative assistant, and she's this African-American woman. And then there's a young, pretty girl with brown hair, and then there's an older lady in a nurse's outfit.
It's been months since we'd heard from him, Shauna. His account is nearly exhausted, and some bills are already overdue. I've referred every patient he ever had to other physicians. He can't just have vanished off the face of the earth, Brenda. The private investigator I hired told me S.H.I.E.L.D. may have been involved, but in the end, he returned my retainer and quit looking. I think he may have been bought off. Wow, you think? And I'm afraid something terrible may have happened to Don.
And just as she says that, there's a knock on the door. Knock, 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 says the sound effect there. And Fandral comes in. He's not wearing his normal clothes. He's wearing this sort of green 80s garb, green-lined Chuck Converse, and he's got parachute pants on. Very 1985, I have to say. But it looks cool, though. It looks cool. He pulls off the look well. My one complaint about this picture is that Fandral looks like he has a teeny tiny little pinhead. That's my only complaint here.
I bid you greetings, damsels. 'Tis a morning that sings of thy beauty and grace to all the city. Why, the sunlight fair bathes the cloud-capped towers in gold.
And the secretary speaks up.
I'm afraid that Dr. Blake isn't here at the moment.
And I know it well, m'lady.
You do?
You must be Mrs. Barclay, surely. And these surpassingly lovely ladies can only be Shauna Lind and Nurse Stevens. And Nurse Stevens doesn't actually have any lines in this. I'm not ignoring her. She just doesn't say anything. "'Tis a great pleasure and honor for me to meet those who have been so close to Donald Blake in his day.
Do you know Don?
Few know him better, m'lady, and 'tis on his business that I have come to see thee.
Where is he? Oh, what has happened to him?
Fear not, Shauna. His government hath need of him, and he hath answered its call.
I knew S.H.I.E.L.D. was involved.
But the work he hath undertaken is lengthy and dangerous. He may never return. Still, he hath not forgotten thee, and I have been instructed to greet thee in his name and bring you this. His phrase, I believe, was severance pay. And he empties out this red gunny sack. Well, sort of a red cloth bag that he was carrying with him onto the table. And a huge pile of gold coins comes spilling out. And the women look all aghast. And Shauna says,
wait a minute. This isn't American currency.
In sooth, fair lady, 'tis not. But the gold contained within these coins is of a finer grade than any to be found in the mines of earth. And these charms hath Blake also sent as a token of his esteem. And he holds up a choker, kind of the how you have a metal loop. It's not like a chain, but it goes around your neck. And dangling from it is a Thor's hammer pendant. So how obvious can you get? I mean, these ladies, if they don't figure that Don Blake has something to do with Thor at this point, especially these gold coins, a picture of Odin on them, then they've got to be pretty dumb. Anyway, so Fandral says, so, come. Look not to the past, but ahead to the future. Your service to Dr. Blake is at an end. You have known one of the noblest beings to walk the vales of Midgard, and though you shall not henceforth remember him in your waking lives, still your dreams will always be colored by the radiance of his presence, and your hearts shall be glad, though they know not why. I say, go in peace. Now, this is something we've encountered before. Fandral is using an ability that apparently all the Asgardians have, and Thor has used it in the past among other people, to make mortals forget. I believe we saw Baldur using that the first time it was used in the comic. And so apparently Fandral and probably all the Asgardians have the same ability. And the ladies kind of turn and leave. And yeah, you know, even though they've forgotten Don Blake, I think they're going to kind of wonder where they got these necklaces and these gold coins. So I think this is creating a question as well as wrapping up some plot loose ends. I don't know how hard Simonson thought about this. He was probably forced to write this by editorial edict. The other possibility, of course, is that he absolutely had no interest in these characters or using them ever again. So he just had to find a way to get rid of them out of the series. So the women leave and Fandral
reaches up and he grabs the Dr. Don Blake sign. He rips it off the door and pops the rivets right out of it, which you'd think it would damage the sign, but it doesn't.
And so 'tis done. In moments they will have forgotten all they knew of Donald Blake and be none the worse for it. But I think I should carry this placard with me. Thor might well delight in the souvenir of the time he spent as a mortal amongst such beauty. Next issue, The Icy Hearts. And that is Thor 354. So yeah, again, they're wrapping up the loose ends here from the prior run. And so, to those of us who haven't read those comics or haven't read them for years and years, it just won't make a lot of sense because it's going to be quite a while probably before we cover those issues. But there it is. It's in the issue, so that's it. All right, so it's about time to wrap up the show. Thanks very much for listening. I really appreciate the feedback that I've gotten over the past week, and I do hope to hear from more people as we go forward here. Once again, we are a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. Thanks to all of you from CPN who have tuned into the show. It's very greatly appreciated, and please get involved in the show. Once again, the email address for the show is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. So from Chicago, Illinois, former home of Dr. Donald Blake, this is Tom Harris. Thank you for listening to Radio Free Asgard, and we will see you next week.